This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with attorney Buck Davis about a recent altercation at a University of Michigan event that has resulted in an interesting lawsuit.
A doctor who attended a peaceful protest at the University of Michigan tried to stop police officers from brutally attacking peaceful protesters. Now she's being charged with two felonies.
We'll also speak with Paul Wright, editor of the publication Prison Legal News. Paul will discuss the background of several prison-related lawsuits. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
When he first requested the records for medical malpractice cases involving inmates in the year 2000, Paul Wright never imagined how much trouble it would be. Now, after nearly 6 years of legal battles over alterations to original documents and failure to produce crucial records in a timely fashion, Mr. Wright finally has the records, a story, and the largest public records-related settlement in Washington state history of over $540,000. Joining us today is Paul Wright, editor of Prison Legal News, a publication that looks into our correctional facilities and reports on inmates' rights. Paul is also on the board of the National Lawyers Guild. In September, the Washington Coalition for Open Government will honor him with the James Madison Award. Welcome, Paul, to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show, Heidi.
Paul, can you give our listeners just a brief background on the two cases that we're discussing today?
Yes. In 2000, I filed a records request on behalf of Prison Legal News with the Washington Department of Corrections, trying to find out how many doctors in their employment had been disciplined for killing or maiming the prisoners in their care. And I was also trying to find out how many doctors were currently employed by the Washington Department of Corrections that didn't have medical licenses or were practicing with suspended medical licenses. And
give us a little background on that. Tell us, how much of a problem is it that you have doctors either who are unqualified or performing poorly on prisoners?
Well, this is a huge problem, not just in Washington, but around the country. And that's the reason I filed the records request, because the pattern that had been happening then and continues to happen, unfortunately, is that prisoners will die of medical neglect. They get sexually assaulted by the doctors and things like that. And then it turns out, well, the doctor didn't have a medical license. Their medical license had been previously suspended. Or in a lot of cases, they had lengthy histories of medical misconduct, everything from sexually assaulting female patients, which then results in their licenses being suspended. But then the suspension is suspended as long as they only treat male patients, which generally prisons is the only place they can actually do that. And in most cases, these are repeat offenders. It's not like we've got Marcus Welby who has some issues. It's usually they're people that have a lot of problems and they aren't good doctors. And they wind up being employed in prisons and jails. And that was one of the things I was trying to find out, was just how deep was the problem. Because the stories that Prison Legal News had been covering up until that point was pretty much after the fact. In other words, once they're getting around to firing someone, after the latest one or two people have been killed through medical neglect. So I was trying to be a little proactive here and see how many people do they know are already in the situation.
Is there something that caused you to focus on Washington?
I was in prison in Washington State at that time, and we'd had the most consistent coverage of medical care in Washington. Myself, I'd personally witnessed a number of cases where prisoners had died of medical neglect, where one case, a prisoner named Stanley Watson, he goes to the prison hospital. He's complaining of chest pains, classic heart attack symptoms. They gave him an EKG, said he was fine. They gave him milk of magnesia, told him he just had some heartburn, and he collapsed dead of a heart attack the next morning. And it turned out, I filed a complaint with the state Medical Quality Assurance Commission. They did an investigation. It turned out that the software hooked to the EKG machine in the prison hospital didn't work. And even if it had, the person that was on duty at the time wasn't qualified to read the EKG results. And because they weren't qualified, they didn't know that the results they were reading were invalid. But that's kind of typical. This is kind of like the tip of the iceberg.
So taking us back to what happened, were you successful in getting the records that you asked for?
Well, that's what led to the litigation, is I asked for the records in 2000. After a lot of delays, procrastination, and excuses, finally around June of 2000, the Washington Department of Corrections produced around 1,200 pages of records, but they redacted the names of all the doctors that had been disciplined for misconduct. So based on what I could read, though, that hadn't been blacked out, we knew that around 14 medical employees over a four-year period had been disciplined for the deaths of two prisoners and the maiming of eight others. And of course, they were still being kept on the state payroll. And as it turned out, their excuse was if they revealed the names of the doctors and medical staff that had been disciplined for medical neglect, then prisoners would know who the doctors were and then they wouldn't seek medical care or treatment from them. And of course, the flip side is, well, why are you employing these people in the first place?
Mm-hmm, of course.
We went to court to seek the names of the doctors in 2000, and that turned into pretty much a very long legal battle. We lost in front of the trial court, where the trial judge basically bought that argument. We lost again in the state appeals court. Finally, we got to the state Supreme Court, and we won 6-3.
That's fabulous.
And the state Supreme Court held that basically, they couldn't shield the names of wrongdoers on the tax payroll, that the public has a right to know who these people are. And it was a pretty significant victory, not just in the prison context, but this also applies to all government employees, whether it's school board members or school employees, police officers, firemen, anyone that's on the public payroll that's actually been disciplined and found guilty by their agency of misconduct, the public has a right to know who they are.
That applies to just the state of Washington?
Yes, this was a Washington the case was based on Washington's public records law.
Paul, tell us a bit about Prison Legal News and how you brought the case. Who were the attorneys on the case?
Prison Legal News is a monthly magazine, and we report on all aspects of the criminal justice system. Our website is at www.prisonlegalnews.org. We have news from around the country, and we cover everything from sentencing issues, drug policy reform, three strikes, to control units, medical issues, mental health, DOC corruption, misconduct, excessive force, pretty much the whole gamut. And this is kind of one of the things that we do. And as part of our journalistic coverage, we also do investigative reporting. And a lot of times that entails having to file public records requests with government agencies, because literally these are the only people that have the information. And the prisons serve very well, not just to keep the prisoners in, but also to keep the information in, especially when it comes to information about misconduct or malfeasance. That's the stuff they really want to keep under wraps.
Now, how much of the work is actually done from within correctional facilities in terms of the reporting, the work that goes into Prison Legal News?
At this point, Prison Legal News, we have six full-time employees, and we have around a dozen contributing writers. Most of our regular contributing writers are prisoners. And one of the things about each 48-page issue of the magazine has between probably 35 and 40 articles in it, and probably around 95% of those are written by current or former prisoners. That's one of the things that makes us kind of unique in the publishing world.
There was a settlement, and I understand it was the largest public records-related settlement in the state of Washington for over $500,000. Has that money come yet to Prison Legal News? What will you do with it?
Yes, the settlement, after 7 years of litigation, the state belatedly produced the records. Of course, on the one hand, they kind of killed the story, because at this point, the news is 7 years old. And that's one of the kind of the realities, the bittersweet realities of public records litigation is that basically if they sit on it long enough and fight long enough, they can basically make the information so old that once it's disclosed, it no longer matters. And kind of that's what they did in this case. But that said, Washington is unique in that it's, to my knowledge, it's the only state that provides for financial penalties against government agencies that withhold public records. They wound up agreeing to pay Prison Legal News a little bit over $200,000 in penalties, which is the highest penalty award ever in a Washington State case. They also paid our attorneys from the law firm of Davis, Wright & Tremaine in Seattle. That included Allison Howard, Andy Marr, and Michelle Earl Hubbard. Davis, Wright & Tremaine was awarded a little bit over $341,000 in costs and fees for representing us in this case that dragged on for over 7 years.
You had a second victory. Tell us about that.
Yes. In 2005, we filed a lawsuit against the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and this related to a 2003 records request where we had sought information regarding how much money the Bureau of Prisons paid out to settle litigation by prisoners, contractors, employees, and such. One of the things that we found is that this type of information gives you a really good idea of basically how well or how badly an agency is run. If they're being sued and they're paying out a lot of money, that shows they have some problems. One of the things that we did when we asked for this information, the Bureau of Prisons said that they want around $8,000 just to look for it, and then they want to charge us more money for copying. And this is part of the Bush administration's policy that they've been following since George Bush got elected president in 2000, of basically shutting out the small independent media, nonprofits, and basically people with limited budgets from getting this type of information. It should be public because the Freedom of Information Act has a provision that says that they're supposed to grant waivers for the fees to qualified media entities and nonprofits. And under Bush, that's pretty much ground to a halt.
Yeah, a few years ago, Ashcroft, listeners will remember, changed the presumption. The presumption was always that this information belonged to the public, and unless there was a good reason to withhold it from the public, it should be delivered to the public and to these entities. And he switched that presumption on its head and said, nope, that's not the way it works. This information is ours. It's ours to keep. It's ours to keep private, and you have to struggle for it. And the exception is that you do get it, not the rule. It's made it really hard, not only for you, but for hundreds of people trying to get what should be public information all around the country.
That's exactly it. And one of the things that they've done, though, is they tried using these exorbitant fees and costs to basically dissuade people from asking. And the reality is that if you're a small nonprofit like Prison Legal News, you don't have a huge amount of money to get what you say. I mean, this is public information. It belongs to all of us. And they use these financial barriers to keep the information secret.
What did you think when you got this bill from the government?
Well, I've done enough public record stuff that very little surprises me, and this is pretty much par for the course. And I realized that this was – they really don't want the information out there. They really don't want people to know how much money they're paying in cases that basically they lose. So I figured, well, we need to go to court and see how it holds up in court. And we're represented by Ed Elder from – he's a National Lawyers Guild lawyer in Washington, D.C., and he represented us on this. And Judge Walton in the District of Columbia issued a great opinion where basically said, yes, Prison Legal News is a media entity, and the fact that we have a small circulation means we're still entitled to the waiver of the fees.
So they were trying to charge you because they didn't agree that you were a media publication?
Right, and they were trying to say that because we had a small circulation, we weren't – it's almost a catch-22, whereas basically if you're the New York Times, you don't get the fee waiver because it's presumed, well, you can afford to pay for it. And then if you're small, they use the thing, well, your circulation, you're not going to reach enough people with this information when you get it to give you the fee waiver. It's a real catch-22 argument.
So essentially no one's entitled to this fee waiver in their eyes.
In their eyes, exactly. And that's one of, and the thing is they use this stuff to dissuade people. And Prison Legal News isn't the only organization that's been faced with this. A couple of years ago, the New York Times ran an editorial on a number of other nonprofits that were also being faced with this situation. as well. So it's been an across-the-board policy by the Bush administration to deny independent media and nonprofits access to this information. And not just the Bureau of Prisons, but pretty much across the board, the whole federal government.
Paul, tell us, what future lawsuits, if any, is Prison Legal News considering?
Well, it seems like it's the always something. In addition to public records stuff, we're always filing public records requests and as part of our work. And, you know, it just depends on the agency. Generally, most at the state level, most agencies are pretty cooperative. It's just when you start running up with the Department of Corrections, they seem to be pretty problematic and have real problems with the concept of government openness. So that's kind of an ongoing thing. One of the other problems that we face a lot around the country is a lot of prisons and jails are hostile to our magazine because we tell prisoners what their rights are and how to successfully vindicate them in court. And we do a lot of exposés that people running prisons and jails would just as soon not have the people in their care know about. So we wind up having a lot of censorship issues.
And what has happened? What's the status of the second lawsuit, Paul?
Well, Judge Walton held that the BOP had to release the documents without requiring a payment of the fees. So here we are 14 months later. They've released some of the documents, and they're redacting a bunch of them. Basically, they're taking the position that people who have successfully sued the government, no one should know who they are, and no one should know. And more importantly, the government employees who were basically that the government is paying money to resolve claims about their misconduct, then no one should know who those government employees are. So I think we're kind of getting ready for round two of litigation in that case.
And taxpayers are paying for litigation that on the government side when they continue to refuse to hand over these documents.
Yes, the court's already awarded $48,000 in attorney's fees to our lawyers in this case.
In addition to costs of...
But I think this goes to the whole government strategy is to stall. I asked for these records in 2003, okay? We didn't get the records until we didn't get a court order saying we're entitled to the records until 2006, and here we are in 2007. They still haven't produced everything they're supposed to, and most of the stuff they've produced, they're basically illegally redacting to keep under wraps the identities of people that are violating the rights of the prisoners in their care, that are bilking the government, or have otherwise been – some of the stuff that's real interesting in these cases are the employee litigation claims. You know, it's not just the prisoners that are mistreated by these prisons, but you have minority and women employees that, you know, they're subjected to racial harassment, gender-based discrimination, sexual harassment, and – that's why these records are so important, is it sheds a real window on to the inner operations of these government agencies, and that's why they want to keep it secret.
Now, Paul, they're government agencies, but tell us a bit about the role that or the effect that privatization of corrections may have had on this.
Well, one of the problems that you wind up with, we do a lot of coverage on the private prison industry, and the government prisons are by no means a panacea of any type, and we're basically talking about rotten apples and rotten oranges here. But the difference is, at least with the Bureau of Prisons, they withhold records. We can currently go into federal court in the Freedom of Information Act and make them give us the records. Not right away, but eventually, somewhere down the line, we will get the records. Problem is that you go up against the private prison industry, and they aren't subject to the Federal Freedom of Information Act. And depending on the state, in a couple of states, eight private companies that contract solely with the government are subject to that state's public records laws. In fact, we have a public records suit going against GeoCorp, which was formerly known as Wackenhut Corrections, asking for some of their records on lawsuit payouts and also where they've been found to not be in compliance with their contracts. But that's the exception to the rule. So in most states, privatization also means a total lack of public accountability. Not that there's much in the way of transparency or accountability in government prisons, but with private prisons, any even a pretense of transparency is thrown out the window. And literally, they treat everything as a trade secret. A couple years ago, we asked Corrections Corporation of America where all their prisons were and the mailing addresses for them, because we were trying to make sure that we had the correct mailing address for all the prisoners in their custody that were also Prison Legal News subscribers. And their response was that the mailing addresses to their facilities was a trade secret, and there's no way to get it out of them. That's just kind of one example of how privatization also serves to eliminate what little public oversight or public accountability there is in the criminal justice system.
What percentage of our prisons are run by private corporations? What kind of accountability?
Well, this is almost a case of back to the future. Up until the 1920s, large sections of American prisons were run by private companies and private corporations. They had what was called the convict lease system, where prisoners were held in state custody, but then companies would pay the state to care for the prisoners. In fact, most of the railroads and roads in the South were built with convict labor, most of them poor blacks that had been nominally freed from slavery after the Civil War, but quickly found themselves quickly incarcerated. And literally some of the biggest prisons in the South are built on former slave plantations like Parchman, Mississippi, and Angola, Louisiana. The companies would literally lease the prisoners and literally work them to death. The average lifespan of a prisoner in Louisiana in the 1890s, 1910 was 5 years. They were literally worked to death. And as a result of those abuses and outrages, that pretty much ended by the 1920s. One would have thought, you know, this prison privatization was a horrible experiment. You know, we've seen what a fiasco it is and the abuses that it engenders and the corruption. Let's move on. But like a lot of bad ideas, this one didn't die. So in 1984, a guy named Doc Krantz got the brilliant idea of starting Corrections Corporation of America. And he did this with some friends of his that were Republican Party hacks. They saw that as the prison population was expanding and increasing, they thought, well, this is an expanding market. And this fit right in with Reagan's whole thing of privatization of government services, which is also kind of another way of transferring public money in the way of tax dollars into private hands. So CCA started in 1984, and at this point in the United States, there's 2.3 million people in prison. Probably around 7% of that total is held in private prisons. CCA is the leader. They've got around 65,000 prisoners under their control at any given time. Geo Corporation is the second biggest one. They've got around 50,000. And between those two companies, they have probably around 80-85% of, as they put it, the market share in warm bodies.
Well, treatment of prisoners in America is certainly rife with human rights abuses, no matter who's in custody of these people. However, one of the things that really concerns me is, and a lot of people, is the question of what kind of standards are private corporations being held accountable to? How does that compare to the abysmal treatment that people receive when they're incarcerated in federally run prisons or state-run prisons?
You know, that's one of the things that I point out is that the whole difference between between the private prisons and the government prisons is that abuses occur in both of them. There's not much in the way of accountability for either one. But a key difference, though, is that if the warden at a government-run prison denies a prisoner medical care and the prisoner dies, the warden isn't getting a bonus on his salary paycheck for denying medical care. Whereas in private prisons, that's literally what happens. The less care you give, the more money you make. And the whole private prison industry is premised upon cutting corners. And the biggest corner that they cut, 80% of the staffing of the costs of running a prison are related to staffing. And the biggest thing where they make the money isn't just they chintz the prisoners on stuff like everything from toilet paper to clean linen and medical care. But the big thing is they understaff the prisons to the extent that prisons have been used as a kind of a modern jobs program. In a lot of states like New Jersey, here in New York, Connecticut, prison guards make pretty good money. You can, especially if you're in upstate or economically depressed areas of the state, prison guards can be making anywhere from $40,000 to $60,000, $70,000 a year. But where the private prisons make the big bucks is first they short-staff the prisons. In other words, if a prison should be having, say, 400 guards employed, they'll staff it with 300 to hope for the best. And the other thing is the salaries they pay the guards. In a lot of states, for example, in Louisiana and Mississippi, places like that, CCA and GEO, they're paying their guards like $7 an hour with no benefits. That's one of the reasons that, first off, they have extremely high turnover. And that's how they're really making a lot of money. And that's one of the things, like for some states, one state that sends out 500 of its prisoners each year to CCA prisons is Vermont. Rather than enact any type of – and Vermont's a small state. They have around 2,000 people in prison. 1,500 of them are in prison in Vermont. 500 of them are in prisons – CCA-run prisons in Kentucky. And rather than enact, say, sentencing reform or reducing the number of prisons or even building prisons in Vermont, the corrections commissioner says that, well, it's actually cheaper for us to send people to CCA prisons in Kentucky because they're only charging us around $60 a day for each prisoner, whereas if we keep them locked up in Vermont, it's over $100 a day. And the difference is Vermont pays its prison guards pretty much a livable wage. They have full benefits in that, whereas the CCA guards at the prison in Kentucky are making a little bit more than minimum wage, don't have benefits, no pension plan, and stuff like that. So that's where the private prison industry really makes its money. And almost every incident that I've seen involving private prisons, whether it's riots, rapes, killings, and that usually in some form is related to their understaffing of the prisons in one way or another. And that's where they really make their money.
In addition to the FOIA,
sure,
that prisons in America are one of our many dirty little secrets that people just have no idea about. If you had to share with our listeners a story that really describes some of the major problems that we have with incarceration in America, what would that story be?
I think in a lot of respects, some of the biggest problems are what's going on in prisons is that the wider public doesn't know about them. The other biggest issue is the fact that there's no accountability, because it doesn't really matter. We report and document all the time on abuses that happen in prisons and jails, and pretty much no one's accountable. The buck doesn't stop anywhere. And I guess I'll go back to our public records case, Prison Legal News versus Washington. One of the cases that we found out about was one of the prisoners was a guy named Charles Snipes. And he was a mentally ill black man being held at the Monroe Correctional Center in Monroe, Washington, and he had a lot of health problems. He was mentally ill. He was obese. He had AIDS. He had hepatitis. He started complaining of chest pains and shortness of breath, and the prison nurse, a woman named Gloria Wagner, came to see him. She looked at him through the slot in his segregation door and said he was just faking, that there's nothing wrong with him. So anyways, he had a heart attack. And he fell to the floor, and basically he died on the floor of his cell, and he was there for 2 days. Prison employees and Gloria Wagner come around, and oh, he's just faking. At one point, a prison lieutenant is squirting him with a spray bottle, and they're throwing socks at him through the slot in his door to see if they can get him to move, because they're going on this thing, oh, he must be faking.
Refusing all food and water. They think he's faking it.
Yeah. By the time they realize he's dead and actually got him to a hospital, rigor mortis hadn't just set in. Rigor mortis had gone. And that's usually that's a long process for the time for rigor mortis. You know, people die, rigor mortis sets in, and then it goes. And anyways, when all was said and done, and this is one of the records that they kept secret for so long, is it turned out that when all was said and done, Gloria Wagner got a letter of reprimand for letting Charles Snipes die on the floor of his cell. His family, as far as I can tell, the records that we uncovered, that was the only one that resulted in a lawsuit. The state of Washington paid Charles Snipes' family $225,000 for letting him die of medical neglect on the floor of his cell. They wound up
paying. That's it.
And the upshot is they wound up paying around $541,000 for covering up the records related to his death. So I don't know. The story really doesn't have a happy ending.
And yeah, it's not about saving money. It's about covering up.
It's all about covering up. And Gloria Wagner, as far as I know, still has a job with the Washington Department of Corrections. So, and that's kind of the bottom line with so much of this stuff. And that's what I mean that there's no accountability. Is it's people get maimed, people get killed, people die, and the people that do it still have a job.
If you're just joining us, we're with Paul Wright, editor of Prison Legal News.
Can listeners who are moved to do something about the scathing conditions in correctional facilities around the country, what can they do? Subscribe to Prison News?
If you want to keep informed on what's going on, Prison Legal News, we have the most comprehensive coverage of pretty much everything related to prisons. And you can go to our website at www.prisonlegalnews.org. You can see our print issues are up there. We have a huge amount of information pretty much from all over the country on all aspects of information related to prison stuff. And as far as trying to push for change, unfortunately, that's one of the problems, is that I can't think of pretty much any politicians that, you know, positive prison reform is even on the agenda. That's one of the problems. You know, we don't even have accountability. I mean, we just have so many layers of problems. First, it's finding out what's going on in the prisons and jails. And then secondly, once you find out what's going on, is how do you hold anyone accountable for what happens? And unfortunately, kind of almost as a complete abdication of leadership by the executive and legislative branches of government, it's been left to the courts to provide what little accountability and oversight there is for prisons and jails in this country. That's pretty haphazard at best.
It's been just enlightening to have you as a guest. We really hope to have you join us again to discuss any future developments through litigation that Prison Legal News has brought.
Okay, we have a lot more, unfortunately.
And probably not even the tip of the iceberg.
Yep. Thank you, Paul. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you for joining us.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
At a University of Michigan event sponsored by the American Movement for Israel, Dr. Catherine Wilkerson attended a peaceful protest against the speaker, who was there to advocate for preemptive war against Iran. When the peaceful protesters were attacked by police, the doctor tried to intervene and provide appropriate medical assistance. Later, when she tried to complain about the police brutality, she was charged with two felonies. Joining us today is her attorney, Buck Davis. He's a National Lawyers Guild attorney with the Police Accountability Project working on this case. Buck, tell us about this latest case that's generating a little bit of buzz, the Dr. Catherine Wilkerson case that we've heard about.
Catherine Wilkerson is a part of a group of people in Ann Arbor who have been protesting Israeli policies toward the Palestinians for a good while, including picketing synagogues. And this pretty rabid pro-Israeli Zionist pressing for war in Iran came to the University of Michigan last November the 30th in order to give a speech sponsored by a Jewish student organization. Five or so people went there to protest Cantor and the content of his speech and the idea that we should preemptively start a war with Iran. University of Michigan has a heckling policy which says you can go and heckle and you can't be so disruptive that the speaker can't be heard or can't get their message across, but that the policy is not to be lightly invoked. There were two Iranian women there, one of whom is a professor of Iranian history at the University of Michigan, and some other local activists. One of the Iranian women started heckling or protesting Tantor's talk.
And Tantor was there speaking again about
promoting a war with Iran in order to protect Israeli security. Apparently, the inmates were in charge of the asylum, and the UM police were acting pretty much at the direction of the Jewish Students Organization as to when they ought to take action to stop the heckling. And the heckling wasn't particularly pronounced or loud or prolonged, but the UM police moved immediately. We know that the event was videotaped, and we've repeatedly tried to get a videotape of what happened, and everybody denies that they can find it, and therefore everybody gets to engage in a liar circus about what happened to start the incident. At any rate, this really large officer leaped on this lady and had her down. First one and then another of the protesters went to her assistance to try to keep the officer from hurting her.
So at this point, was the officer lying on top of her?
Yes, and also apparently striking her in some fashion. These protesters are all, I won't say old, but they're not students. I mean, these are people that have been activists or mature adults or individuals. At any rate, the two who went to the lady's aid, including the UM professor, who is herself a woman, were quickly arrested, taken outside. Dr. Wilkerson was there as a part of the protest, and when she went outside, she saw this officer on top of an older guy by the name of Coleman, and it appeared to her that he was being crushed or asphyxiated by this officer, appeared to be on the verge of losing consciousness. She identified herself as a doctor and repeatedly said to the officer, "Stop doing what you're doing. It's dangerous. It could be life-threatening. I'm a doctor. I'm willing to. Please let me check his vital signs," or whatever. Finally, the officer relented enough to allow her to check Coleman and make sure that he was still alive, but would not unhandcuff him, and he was handcuffed and lying in such a way that there's a danger of what's known as positional asphyxiation. And that was the state of affairs for a number of minutes while Wilkerson was trying to render aid to the injured individual, and the police was basically refusing to allow her to do so. and the local emergency medical ambulance arrived, whereupon the officer turned the prisoner over to the arrestee, over to the EMTs, pushed Wilkerson away from the scene, twisting her arm.
From what I've read, some reports indicate that this gentleman, when he was on the ground with the police officer using force on him, he was complaining that he could not breathe, and at one point he actually passed out. Are those reports accurate?
Yes. That was why Wilkerson was trying to get the officer to quit, to change his position, to unhandcuff him, whatever.
So the gentleman lost consciousness, and still the police officer never relented?
He was in and out of consciousness. He wasn't completely unconscious the entire time, but he was on the edge of unconsciousness for the entire time.
Buck, the good Dr. Wilkerson, is she now stand charged with interfering with a police officer in the performance of his duty? Is that what it is?
Yes.
You know, I happen to know what a fine trial lawyer you are, and so I would love, I'd almost be worthwhile to fly back to Detroit to watch you hand them their tuchus in a trial, because I can't imagine anybody's going to convict that poor woman. But, you know, in keeping with the theme that we were talking about here earlier in the show, how has the movement responded to it there? Are a lot of the folks there that were out at that protest now rallying to her defense?
There is a committee called the Committee to Defend Catherine Wilkerson. What happened was is that the EMTs who were on the scene also acted inappropriately. They used ammonia inhalants on the guy, and that's pretty old-timey medical practice. Wilkerson again protested, saying, "You can't do that to him."
Why couldn't ammonia inhalants be a good course of action?
Medical literature shows that for people that are having trouble breathing, ammonia inhalants, which you see them in the movies and people snap their heads up and it makes a difference. Actually,
smelling salts.
It makes the condition worse. There's a pretty big case down in Florida where they did it to a kid in a youth camp and killed him. Anyway, ammonia inhalants are dangerous to use under most circumstances and are not preferred medical practice and not even standard medical equipment. Anyway, Wilkerson continued to protest that. They grabbed her, twisted her arm, pushed her off to the side, and made her wait for a while before they let her go. She, about 6 weeks later, wrote a letter of complaint to the Ann Arbor Police Department and to the University of Michigan Police. And 7 days later, they brought charges against her, both for attempting to interfere with the police officer and with attempting to interfere with the EMTs. So it's attempt interference by attempting to practice her medical profession. We brought a motion, medical necessity defense. Judge denied it, saying that it was improper to decide the case before trial, but that if the proofs bore out our claims about the medical necessity and the protocols and the duty of EMTs to yield to a physician on the scene and various other issues, that we might win that one on summary judgment. At the trial, we also brought a First Amendment retaliation defense claim, saying, Jesus, how can you not arrest the lady that night, not do anything about it for 6 weeks, and then when she complains about your wrongdoing, bring these charges? And they actually said in open court, we didn't know who she was until she wrote the letter.
Oh, sure.
Dr. Wilkerson is a quite strong political lady. Her husband is a doctor who is also the medical advisor to the local county SWAT team. He knows all about it. This is just nuts.
Yeah.
There's no way to tell where the political pressure is coming from, whether it's because of the Israeli question, whether people are putting pressure, but we think that the pressure to bring this case came from the president of Mary Sue Coleman, the president of the University of Michigan, that without her office's benediction, it wouldn't have happened.
What's her interest in the case?
Well, it got quite a bit of publicity at the time. There are a lot of protest letters that were written. When you get into matters of criticizing Israel or Jewish student organizations, a lot of people get interested in, and those people have an enormous amount of political power, not only in Ann Arbor and at University of Michigan, but through AIPAC, as we know, through the United States Congress. Why Wilkerson's letter pushed them over the edge, we don't know. They claim that they don't have any documents because they didn't know who she was. But we're going to subpoena a lot of records from a lot of places, and we think we can prove that's a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when she decided to make the protest and adverted to the fact that she still had an arm injury and required physical therapy from the way they handled her that night, they decided that they needed to go on the offensive rather than the defensive.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, we have this woman, a doctor, who attended a protest, saw police abusing another protester, tried to intervene, offer her medical expertise, and protect the person being abused. And now she's being charged with interfering with a police officer's duties.
Right.
So tell us where you are in the case and what you expect to happen next.
It's set for trial at the beginning of October, I think October 3rd. We are issuing subpoenas for all the records that we assume must exist in terms of their response to our early FOIA request, which they refused, their response to citizens' complaint, which we had a meeting set up with the police when they brought the charges, the communications between Ann Arbor Police, University of Michigan Police, the Huron Valley Ambulance Company, and the prosecutor's office. We believe that when we get those subpoenas out, they're going to realize that the statements that they've made in court are patently untrue. We expect there to be a big fight about those subpoenas. We're going to hire a national expert on the ill-advised use of ammonia inhalants. We expect that the judge, when she sees what this trial is turning into, the judge is the next prosecutor, but reasonably fair so far, and obviously thinks that this is a big mess in her courtroom. We think that the trial will be adjourned, but unless the prosecutor's office decides to back off, we will sometime before the end of the year have to go to trial.
Mm-hmm.
If our listeners hear about this and they're concerned about it, they want to somehow voice their concern, where would you direct them? Is there something they could do?
The committee to defend Catherine Wilkerson. The spokesperson is a lady by the name of Amy, A-I-M-E-E, Smith. Telephone 734-761-9901. And there's a website, defendwilkerson.org. The address for the committee to defend Catherine Wilkerson is P.O. Box 8041, Ann Arbor, Michigan, 48107. And Dr. Wilkerson's personal email is cwilkersonmd@sbcglobal.net.
And I assume, if nothing else, financial support can always be appreciated.
From the lawyer's point of view, it would be.
Yeah, I can imagine. So one point of clarification, because I know a lot of eyebrows will go up. In your introduction, you mentioned that the doctor participates in many protests against Israeli discrimination against Palestinians.
Yeah.
And some of those protests happen in front of synagogues. Can you clarify that? We want to make sure people don't think this doctor is protesting religious folks who want to go into worship.
These are various Alan Haber, one of the founders of SDS and founder of the Megiddo Project, which is an international peace project, is a part of this group of people. There are some people, and so I would say that at least half of the group that does the protesting is Jewish, but there are some people who feel so strongly about what's happening in Palestine, and I'm one of them, that they feel like they have to do something. And they feel rightly, I believe, that until the American Jewish community, which I don't believe is represented by the major Jewish organizations or AIPAC, I mean, I think that most Jewish people in this country are at least concerned, if not appalled, about what's happening and the way Israel is treating the Palestinians, that until the people, the Jewish people of this country, stand up and say, not in our name, then the United States policy is going to be slavishly in favor of Israel, as it has been, as a point of local contact and raise those issues. I think it's courageous of them to very peacefully raise the Palestinian issue outside of a synagogue.
I couldn't agree with you more, Buck. And out in Ann Arbor, I remember learning from Larry Hockman, your former partner, that they were initiating these actions. And I thought it was just an extraordinary thing to do that.
Yeah.
Keep up the good work.
Absolutely, Buck.
I mean, this is one of the most politicized cases I've had for a long time. As things develop, I'll be happy to keep you all updated, but thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Buck.
Buck, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate the work you're doing, and we hope to have you and Catherine on again to talk about your victory.
Yes.
I hope.
Excellent. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye, Buck.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.